This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So yesterday, the Trump campaign legal team did their first press briefing, and it was, well, you tell me what you thought of it. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. I am glad they did it because, as I've said from the outset, this is a case that's being prosecuted in courts of law, but it also needs to be prosecuted in the court of public opinion. You need to bring the public along with the arguments that are being made, the evidence as such that you can present for public viewing to try to advance the arguments for the purpose of keeping people in the fold. And also, to the extent that you are successful, gaining legitimacy in the public mind that, yes, what you're alleging did in fact happen. And yes, whatever remedy was ultimately meted out was an appropriate one. So it was good that they did it. Rudy Giuliani took the lead, and he sort of made a general statement that he then spent about 45 minutes developing.
Because there's not a singular voter fraud in one state. This pattern repeats itself in a number of states, almost exactly the same pattern, which to any experienced investigator, prosecutor, would suggest that there was a plan from a centralized place to execute these various acts of voter fraud, specifically focused on big cities, and specifically focused on, as you would imagine, big cities controlled by Democrats, and particularly focused on big cities that have a long history of corruption.
Right. And he also essentially said that the Biden campaign was orchestrating it. Didn't present any evidence of that, but that's essentially the logical conclusion that he's suggesting be drawn based on what he says is, to borrow perhaps the word of 2020, systemic fraud that occurred in big cities and swing states around the country and, you know, the six jurisdictions, the six states that are mainly in question here. There are buckets of assertions of categories of voter fraud. So the buckets of voter fraud, not allowing poll watchers to inspect the count. That's one area.
Right.
And you know, as you think about the buckets of alleged voter fraud, you have to think of, number one, how much specific physical evidence, in addition to affidavits, which we'll get to, can the campaign pull together? And secondly, what are the remedies to the extent you met the burden? So poll watchers not being allowed to inspect the ballot. No inspection of absentee ballots in some states and jurisdictions within those states. In other words, not looking to verify the signature, not looking to ensure that it was completed properly. Number three, backdating of ballots. Saying I received this ballot on November 2nd when in point of fact I received it on November 4th. Curing of ballots, particularly in Pennsylvania. The idea that some people were contacted by their election officials in counties, like some of the more Democrat counties, saying you filled out your ballot wrong, come in and we'll spoil that ballot and we'll let you fill out a new one. And in other counties, you were not allowed to do that. And the reason you weren't allowed to do that in Pennsylvania, to use that example, is because there's no provision in state law that you're allowed to do that. And that actually triggers an equal protection claim that I think is fairly compelling for the Supreme Court. So poll watchers, no inspection of absentee ballots, backdating of ballots, curing of ballots, the skirting of state election laws. A good example of this would be the indefinitely confined in Wisconsin and allowing everybody who to categorize themselves as indefinitely confined because of COVID rather than what the law was really intended, who the law was really intended to serve. The indefinitely confined don't have to provide voter ID which is the law in Wisconsin. And so you had, you know, 20x the number of indefinitely confined designees in this election that you do in a normal election. Ballot dumping, right? The proverbial stories that have circulated about $100,000 votes being dumped off in the wee hours of Wednesday morning.
People found them on their fields, their farm fields in Iowa. Yeah,
places like Detroit and Philadelphia and Milwaukee. Overvoting. This was a specific allegation that was made by Giuliani in the press conference. Overvoting in Wisconsin and Michigan. Meaning, we've talked about it in the show, the precincts, some precincts in awards in Milwaukee where you had 200% of 100% to 200% of a particular precinct that voted. They have same day registration. Right. But even with same day registration, you have 200% of the voters that are on the rolls turn out to vote in a particular precinct. And then double counting, too. They drop off these ballots. There's just the vote for the presidential election. And then the allegation is they're running them through the machine 2 and 3 times. That was an allegation that was made yesterday as well. So you're talking about, you know, 8 different sort of buckets of voter fraud. I think some are more compelling than others. Some are easier to amass physical evidence than others.
Yeah, but it's not enough to overturn the election results, is it? Well, they didn't prove that yesterday.
Well, they didn't set out to prove that yesterday.
It was 2 hours. It was embarrassing. That was a Saturday Night Live skit gone awry.
It was?
Yeah. It went on for 2 hours. First of all, you're not effective if you keep talking. And then Rudy Giuliani talked about My Cousin Vinny.
Did you all watch My Cousin Vinny? You know the movie? It's one of my favorite war movies because he comes from Brooklyn. And when the nice lady who said she saw, and then he says to her, how many fingers do I got up? And she says, 3. Well, she was too far away to see it was only 2. These people were further away than my cousin Vinny was from the witness.
So the context of that My Cousin Vinny example was...
Because the poll watchers couldn't see the ballots because they were too far away.
And then the ninth category of potential voter fraud is what Sidney Powell laid out with respect to manipulation of voting tabulation by the vendors or somebody that had access to the machinery of the election, Dominion Voting System, Smartmatic, the actual machines plus the software platform. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. In terms of it being a Saturday Night Live skit, no, I don't think so. I don't think so. I'm sorry you don't like Rudy Giuliani's, you know, colorful illustration of the problem with not allowing poll watchers to actually view the counting process. Perhaps he could have picked a different movie for you, but it's a legitimate issue to raise. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court decision makes no sense. The idea that you have no right to stand within a certain distance of the count.
Oh, yeah, it's poll jive. I mean, they should have done it.
Well, then why would you have the provision for poll watchers at all if they can't see the count? That's the entire purpose for it.
Right. And why would in Detroit and Wayne County, would you cover the windows so people couldn't see election counting?
Well, that's sort of a different issue, so long as poll watchers are allowed in the facility, because that was for outsiders who were gathered outside, mm-hmm. Outside the facility. But yeah, it doesn't look good. You know, what are you trying to hide? This is just vote counting. You should be willing to do this on the 6 o'clock news. Right. What's the controversy here? So with respect to the poll watching issue, I don't think that's the most compelling. I don't think it's particularly compelling at all. And the reason is not because it's not a serious issue, is because there's not a available remedy in most of the states, unless, and this was not clear to me. I mean, one of the things that was lacking in the press conference was some specifics in certain places. Unless you can say, as Alito demanded in Pennsylvania, that you segregate any absentee ballot, mail-in ballot that came into Pennsylvania after 8 p.m. on election night, And then we now have that batch, that cohort of ballots that's separated, so we can make a determination potentially that is impactful on whether or not the Pennsylvania Supreme Court violated state election law, overreached with respect to their jurisdiction by extending the collection for 3 days post-election. These are material issues, and I think there was a better job done giving some specifics in terms of a roadmap of where they're going when they actually get into court than in other matters with respect to all of these buckets of voter fraud allegations.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, continuing our discussion of the Trump legal team's press briefing yesterday. This was the claim that Rudy Giuliani made. It's a big one.
In the states that we have indicated in red, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Nevada, and Arizona, we more than double the number of votes needed to overturn the election in terms of provable illegal ballots.
Provable illegal ballots in the states in question. We have more than double the votes we need to overturn the election. That's what Rudy Giuliani contended. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. He also noted, as Amy said at the end before Mike Scott's newscast, the Georgia recount is done.
Yeah, the audit's over.
I'm sorry?
I said the audit. It's a recount audit. It's over. It's
right. And now the litigation continues. Rudy Giuliani talking about the lawsuit that's going to be filed in Georgia today. Also, he brought in another state that they're looking at for to possible litigation for some of the same claims he's making about the states where litigation is pending. And that was New Mexico, which was interesting. Giuliani on Georgia.
Georgia. We're about to file a major lawsuit in Georgia. That'll be filed probably tomorrow. I don't need to go through it. Virtually the same things I've told you before. In the city of Atlanta, Republicans were not allowed to watch the absentee mail-in ballot process. Inspections completely cast aside. And we have numerous double voters. We have numerous out-of-state voters. And we have specific evidence of intimidation and changes of vote.
So, again, it's about 13,000 votes spread in Georgia. But remember what the recount, the hand recount was. It was counting the ballots by hand to see if the hand count matched up with the machine count. It wasn't addressing the underlying issues of whether there were illegal ballots being counted. So thus the litigation. David Schaefer, the GOP chairman, state party chairman in Georgia. More election news never reported. Two Fulton County elections board members, voted against certifying the Fulton County election returns because signatures on absentee ballots were not electronically verified. Because of the massive increase in absentee ballots, Fulton County purchased software to electronically verify signatures, but could not get it to work. It reverted to all manual signature verification. And then the question is, was that manual signature verification actually done? And thus will be the topic, at least one of the topics of the complaint Rudy Giuliani says is going to be filed in Georgia. I want to get to Sidney Powell as well here, just to fold her in, and then we can go back to some of the specifics of what Giuliani alleges in the various states. Sidney Powell continues to make really a major claim. I mean, Tucker Carlson last night suggested it would be the greatest political crime in American history if what she's saying is true. Right.
He wants her to come on the show.
He also took her to task for not coming on the show and not presenting evidence to support these claims. Here's what she had to say yesterday when it was her turn at the podium. She really is sort of giving a story about what she thinks is true. But let's listen to what she says. I mean, it gets into almost like Jean Le Carré spy novel territory here.
What we are really dealing with here and uncovering more by the day is the massive influence of communist money through Venezuela, Cuba, and likely China in the interference with our elections here in the United States. The Dominion voting systems, the Smartmatic technology software, and the software that goes in other computerized voting systems here as well, not just Dominion, were created in Venezuela at the direction of Hugo Chavez to make sure he never lost an election after one constitutional referendum came out the way he did not want it to come out. We have one very strong witness who has explained how it all works. His affidavit is attached to the pleadings of Lynn Wood in the lawsuit he filed in Georgia. It is a stunning, detailed affidavit because he was with Hugo Chavez while he was being briefed on how it worked. He was with Hugo Chavez when he saw it operate to make sure the election came out his way. That was the express purpose for creating this software. He has seen it operate, and as soon as he saw the multiple states shut down the voting on the night of the election, he knew the same thing was happening here, that was what had gone on.
Mm-hmm. Well, just one more from Powell before we address overall what she had to say. The other allegation she made that's relevant is that the explanation for why the vote count stopped in so many places.
Yeah, because that's a point of contention for a lot of voters.
The allegation that it did stop, I mean, first of all.
Well, didn't it stop? I mean, it did stop. If you're watching TV, like all of us, all of a sudden, everyone decided to go home? That has never happened in our history of elections.
I don't know about that. Well, but the vote stopping and why she thinks the vote stopped.
But one of its most characteristic features is its ability to flip votes. It can set and run an algorithm that probably ran all over the country to take a certain percentage of votes from President Trump and flip them to President Biden, which we might never have uncovered had the votes for President Trump not been so overwhelming in so many of these states that it broke the algorithm that had been plugged into the system. And that's what caused them to have to shut down in the states they shut down in. That's when they came in the back door with all the mail-in ballots, many of which they had actually fabricated. Some were on pristine paper with identically matching perfect circle dots for Mr. Biden. Others were shoved in batches. They're always put in a certain number of batches, and people would rerun the same batch. This corresponds to our statistical evidence that shows incredible spikes in the vote counts at particular times, and that corresponds to eyewitness testimony of numerous people who have come forward and said they saw the ballots come in the back door at that time.
Mm-hmm. So the Trump vote broke the Dominion voting system's algorithm, forcing the count to stop, or prompting the count to stop. And that's when the garbage pails full of Biden votes came in and were dropped off.
I mean, it's feasible. It could have happened.
Well, anything's possible, but anything being possible is not a very compelling argument in court. And if you're banking on what Sidney Powell said yesterday and an affidavit from a Dominion voting systems whistleblower, that is not going to be enough. It's not going to be near enough. Now, I know the evidence gathering is still going on. But Sidney Powell, I say again, she's a serious person. Lynn Wood in Georgia's a serious person, mm-hmm. good attorneys. She's making big claims. She's staking her professional reputation on those claims. So I'll give her the benefit of the doubt. But there's a lot more prove up that will be required between now and the timeline they're on, which is like, you know, the second week of December, in order to make what she's saying stick. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Mike in Big Rock, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Big Rock.
Yeah, hi, Dan and Amy. You know what, I first wanted to say, Dan, I just thank God for you because it seems like you always see the big picture. When you talk about the 8 or 9 buckets of the things that have gone on in this election and each front has to be, you know, taken into court and stuff. I didn't see that with Tucker Carlson nor Hugh Hewitt. They were keying in on what Sidney Powell was saying, sort of mocking her. And I would say this, where there's smoke, there's fire. Antrim County, Michigan, did show that the software did switch 6,000 votes.
Right.
So there's some smoke there, and I think she's got the toughest job, Sidney Powell, because you're going to have to go after layer of layer upon maybe corruption in this, finding out if it's a coordinated effort by many people. It's going to be tough, but I'm just praying that she finds it because things just don't add up. And I think Tucker was really wrong. It just sounded like he thought, if you don't come on my show and prove it, you're nothing. And I've never really seen him act like that before. I just thought he could have talked about all the other buckets that we still have going for us. But thanks a lot.
Well, yeah, she's the it girl. I mean, you want her to get on your show to explain herself. But she did do that during the press conference yesterday. I mean, they laid it out, but it just, you know, it got a little goofy and it dragged on and on and on.
Well, there's dragged on and on and on. I mean, I'm sorry the American public, because some percentage of the American public's attention span is that of a circus monkey. But these are complicated cases. And I just went through 9 buckets of allegations that you have to develop.
Right. And you should have done the press conference.
Well, but also, I mean, you know, as Rudy Giuliani's plaintive cry throughout the press conference was, you know, you guys don't cover any of this stuff. You keep saying we have no evidence. Well, let me give you some examples of the evidence we had. He's right when he says that affidavits are evidence. Now, they're not dispositive evidence, but they are evidence. He has witnesses to call in a particular to prosecute a particular allegation. That's good. The problem he has, I think, is does the physical evidence, does it level up to the assertion he's making about what they claim to have? Because witness testimony about what somebody saw at a counting site is not going to be enough. You'll have election officials that, if it ever got to trial, you'll have election officials, I'm sure, from these jurisdictions be called by the state to say, no, that this person misunderstood what was seen, or to even to the extent that something went awry, it was limited in scope and it's not material to the outcome of the election. So the affidavits from Americans, people coming forward and saying, I saw this thing under penalty of perjury, that's a serious thing. And those people should be given some respect, too, particularly because they face so much blowback in coming forward to say anything other than the party line when it comes to this election. And Giuliani made that point as well. But that's not the same thing as saying you're meeting your burden of proof, and you're meeting your burden of proof for the remedy in particular that you seek. And to some extent, in some of these jurisdictions, even is the remedy you seek going to be enough? But the flip side of that is to say, you learned this in law school, to argue both sides. Even the remedy, if the remedy I seek isn't enough, you should grant it anyway, because it provides a correction to something went wrong. And if it turns out that Biden still won Wisconsin or Biden still won Georgia, then it gives the election that much more legitimacy, Your Honor.
I mean, I'm glad the efforts that they're doing, because we do not want voter fraud, because
right.
Then your vote doesn't count, and we don't want to have this happen. But claiming that double the number of votes are going to overturn the election, that's a big
that they have twice
they have
as many
twice
as they
as many,
need.
Right, yeah. That's a big claim. It's a big claim. Yeah,
Biden in Oak Forest. I mean, Biden.
Hey,
Brian in Oak Forest. I have Biden on my mind. Yeah, sorry.
Come on, don't
yeah. Yeah, sorry about that.
Good morning. Happy Friday. I emailed you about a week ago about this Transition Integrity Project. I don't know if you had a chance to read it. I found it, the predictions, very interesting, to say the least. But to your point with the persuading public opinion, I watched ABC News last night at 10 o'clock, and there was zero mention of the cracking. So, of course, like you mentioned many times, I think we're going to have an uphill battle, and who knows if it'll actually be proven.
Yeah.
That's all I got. Have a good weekend.
Thanks for the call,
Mainstream
Brian.
Mainstream media is not touching this.
Well, and by the way, you know, the release of the Kraken, I mean, the question is, does Sidney Powell have a Kraken? You know, it's not clear to me.
Well, and the time is ticking. I mean, if she did, you got to get on that.
Well, right. They're on the timeline. They're on the timeline. So, you know, this is a strategic choice as well. Let's just say, hypothetically, that everything Sidney Powell says is true. You also have to consider exactly what you said, the timeline. So is this where you want to stake your claim, or do you believe that this isn't the only claim you really have to stake that could change the outcome? I mean, it seems to me they're sort of hedging their bets, perhaps, with all of the local allegations with respect to the actual administration of the elections, which I think has actually, there's more opportunities there than just in case, you know, if not this, then what about that? But it's, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Because I don't know what she has. And I said, so I'll give her the benefit of the doubt. I'm not ridiculing her. But she hasn't presented, you know, near enough. And there's no question that you're going to have to connect a lot of dots in a short period of time. And you know how I know she hasn't connected the dots? Is because she's calling for a DOJ criminal investigation into this immediately. Well, first of all, that's not going to happen. And you know, in all likelihood, and she probably knows that. Secondly, it's sort of a tell that says you can't put the case together such that and present it to the public or a court of law such that the DOJ would be compelled to take it up. Greg and Schomburg.
Okay, Dan, then the country is gone. Sidney Powell's investigating things that are all brand new. And she's got to preach to people that are trained in law school that are not necessarily technical advanced, who don't look at things beyond the eight buckets, when the ninth bucket is the one that could sway the vote right off the bat. Amy's point, and Amy, I'm picking you up off the floor right now, is in the duality of the two of you is really good. But there's some mornings when Amy will listen to you for 5 minutes and then bring up the PR point and the point that's actually germane, Dan, in the sense that you got Romney bashing people right now. You got Kavanaugh back on the page. And she's bringing up the issue of the public relations point, which you seem to blow right over. And then
it's funny you say that. If I could stop your Jeremiah for 5 seconds. It's funny you say that since I'm the same person who's been arguing for presentations in the court of public opinion since the outset and the need of being the public along. So you're actually wrong, Greg. And you know what? I'm getting a little exhausted with your coming over the top about software and conspiracy theories that are not proved up because I've got a raft.
Well, then wait.
No, I'm not done. See you, Greg.
Goodbye.
See ya. I've got a raft of software engineers, Bob Zeidman and others that I've spoken with that are raising the same questions about the allegations that are being made on the machinery piece of this, the Dominion and the Smartmatic piece of it that I'm raising and that I'm raising in relation to what Sidney Powell is alleging. So I'm sorry that you think you're the end all be all on this, but you're not. There are legitimate questions to be asked all the way around. And I'm sorry you don't want those questions asked. Now, my interest is in ascertaining the truth. It's also trying to keep focus on what the challenge is in the real-time context, not the nirvana fallacy where we're going to replace what we have to deal with something we wish we could deal with that's not going to happen. So nice try, Greg from Schomburg. And stop being a baby. Goodbye. Let somebody finish and then you can talk, just like I let you talk at the outset. It's being childish. David and Lansing.
Good morning. I'm getting tired of this. Yesterday was another day of left-wing so-called news media trying to push the steal. Rhinos are buying it. And, you know, the left-wing media is censoring the Trump's lawyers team press conference. It took me 15 minutes to power through and find an unedited version of the Giuliani and Trump lawyer press conference, because they're trying to scrub the internet, in my opinion, they're trying to scrub the internet of links to this unedited version, so nobody sees it. And so my solution is to create an email, and this is what I'm doing. I'm creating an email that I found an unedited version of the press conference, and I'm going to continue to do this. I'm going to email it to a county, like businesses and individuals in counties where these votes are contested. I'm going to do this all day. I'm like hundreds of emails. I'm going to flood everybody around those counting areas with this press conference, because the media, let's name them, Time. I mean,
yeah, I get it. The press corps, right? The D.C. press corps, right? No,
CNN,
I get it.
CNN, CBS,
right.
PBS, L.A. Times. Let's give the people what they need. They need to see this press conference. This is a battle in the public. This is a battle in the court of public opinion.
Yes.
Also,
David, we're up against the clock, but I appreciate your call. Thanks for the call.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We'll get back to Rudy Giuliani's comments about Pennsylvania in a moment, but our friend John Solomon over at justthenews.com reached out to Williams College professor Stephen Miller. He's a Yale and Princeton trained math expert. He analyzed Pennsylvania ballot data and looked at did a bunch of phone interviews, too, data from phone interviews of voters in Pennsylvania. Two patterns he found concerning. One involved possible votes that were not counted. The other, ballots that appeared to be requested by someone other than a registered voter. Miller said in a sworn statement provided to Just the News, I estimate that the number of ballots that were either requested by someone other than the registered Republican or requested and returned but not counted range from 89,397 to 98,801. It's a specific range. According to Pennsylvania state data for early and absentee ballot requests, there are roughly 165,000 ballots requested in the names of registered Republican voters that had not been counted as of November 16th. Well, that's interesting. And again, you know, keep the spread in mind here. The spread between Biden and Trump in Pennsylvania is about 82,000 votes. Rudy Giuliani saying that Pennsylvania, not a Biden victory, but a fraud.
Biden, which is not a victory, it's a fraud, is 69,140 votes. The reality is that we are now at a count of 682,770 ballots, for which we have affidavits that there was no inspection of that ballot at the time that it was entered in the vote.
Yeah, so that's a bit of a misleading statement, or it could be taken in a way, I think, perhaps other than what it was intended, to be generous to Giuliani. Number one, there seems to be some discrepancy in how many votes that are down in Pennsylvania. Number two, yes, there's the issue of checking the mail-in ballots, like doing signature verification. But he's not saying he has 682,000 affidavits. He's suggesting that because they weren't checked, those 682,000 votes should be set aside. And that's one of those examples where I don't think there is even the remotest of chance that the courts, including the high court, are going to see setting aside that many votes based on, again, if that's proven up, based on that failure of election authorities as the least intrusive remedy for that failure. Giuliani also, on a more, to me, a more interesting issue, which is the equal protection issue of curing ballots in Pennsylvania, gave a concrete example of what he's talking about so people could understand the problem with allowing some people to, quote unquote, cure their ballot and other people not provided that opportunity because, you know, it's against state law.
One of our plaintiffs, Mr. Henry, cast a absentee ballot, and he failed to put it in the secure envelope inside. He just put it in open, naked. That ballot was cast aside because it was invalid, because that breaks the privacy of the vote. In Pittsburgh and in Philadelphia, if they noticed that there wasn't an inner envelope, they'd contact the voter and allow him to vote again. Or if he didn't fill it out completely, or if he made a mistake and didn't sign his full name, he was allowed to cure it. There is no such provision under the law of Pennsylvania. The Democrat Secretary of State made that up.
Mm-hmm. And again, the equal protection claim calls to mind Bush v. Gore. It's not exactly on point, but substantively, the argument is just as counting Chads one way in one county in Florida and counting them another way in another county is an equal protection problem, and that was a supermajority of the court ruling that. So is the idea that some people could come back and cure their ballot in some counties in Pennsylvania and other people can't or weren't afforded the opportunity. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Greg Tufel. He is the founder of OGC Law LLC based in Pittsburgh. So he's there on the ground in Pennsylvania with some perspective, legal perspective we appreciate. Greg Tufel, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. So, you know, of the various buckets of voter fraud allegations, as I'm terming them, from the poll watchers to the lack of inspection of absentee ballots to the curing of ballots, where do you see the most upside for the Trump campaign in Pennsylvania?
Well, you just mentioned the data where you get into, you know, you've got about a 81,000-82,000 vote split. So the most promising situations are in terms of actually changing the result in PA among the lawsuits and the issues raised so far, I would say have to do with, you know, Republican votes not being counted or Republican votes being turned away because of lack of provisional ballots available at the polling station. And as you just mentioned, you know, districts with counties, I guess, with more Republicans having not having the kind of curing that's happening in the counties with more Democrats.
Well, how many? I know that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court usurped the legislative function and rewrote the PA election code, you know, directing votes received up to 3 days after election day.
Yeah.
How many late votes were counted, and were they separated from the other vote totals?
So that's something that still needs to be nailed down. But I can tell you two data points, so to speak. One is that in Pennsylvania primary, there were over 60,000 votes received after election day that were counted. So you'd expect in the general election the number to be upwards of that number because there's so many more votes in the general election generally. However, I've also seen a quote from Secretary of State McFarr claiming that there were only in the range of 10,000 votes that were counted after Election Day. And there have also seen stories reported about various counties either confirming or not confirming that they did segregate the ballots. I haven't really seen that fully audited to the point of did they really segregate them. You know, initially, I know they polled the various counties and only 25 of them were able to quickly confirm that they were segregating the ballots. And then that's why the U.S. Supreme Court stepped in and ordered that segregation occur. And that was after, by the way, the PA Supreme Court refused to order segregation. And then initially, Secretary of State Buchbar claimed to the U.S. Supreme Court, you don't need to order segregation to occur. I've already done that. I've already directed all the counties to segregate. And initially, the Supreme Court was satisfied with that representation. But then when they went around surveying the counties to see if they were actually following Secretary Bookflor's direction to segregate ballots, they couldn't get confirmation from more than half of them. I think ultimately I saw it reported that some 63 of the counties were able to confirm they did segregate. So I don't know what happened with the last four. I never saw those confirmed. So
if 63 of the 67 have confirmed that they were able to separate out those ballots received after 8 p.m. on Election Day, then why don't we have a general handle on what that overall number is?
I don't know why not. They weren't directed to count and report the total number of segregated ballots, but that information would certainly come up in the lawsuit.
I would think. Something else, too, this Pennsylvania Supreme Court is really an interesting body when they're not writing election law. I agree with Giuliani, at least on this point, that this decision about poll watchers, that there's no right to be within a certain distance. I mean, you don't have to specify the number of feet, but obviously the whole point of having a poll watcher is so that they are within eyeshot of the ballot counting process so they can see what's happening. And the idea that that they don't have to be effectively, well, now they've just overturned essentially the substantive election statute in the state of Pennsylvania, haven't they?
Oh, yeah. And so just so your listeners can understand, the reason why in Pennsylvania it's important that you have ballot watchers or poll watchers, close enough to see what's going on. Under Pennsylvania law, for absentee and mail-in ballots, it states very clearly that the mail-in ballot is not valid where the outer envelope is not certified by the elector or really signed by the voter, basically. And it's not valid, as I think you just mentioned, if there's no secrecy ballot, or I think you were having a quote from Rudy Giuliani saying
right.
If there's no secrecy ballot, it gets rejected. That's another reason. So it has to have a secrecy envelope inside, and then it has to be put aside and not counted. If the secrecy ballot has any markings, which tend to indicate the political preferences of the voter, if it says, go Trump, go Biden, whatever on the bed, that has to be put aside. So these various issues, when they opened it, was there a secrecy ballot? You need to be relatively close to see that. Was the outside envelope signed? You need to be relatively close to see that. Were there any improper markings on the secrecy ballot? You need to be relatively close to see that. You're not going to see that from 15 feet away with someone hunkered over a desk filing through envelopes. And once they tear away the outside envelope and tear away the secrecy envelope and pull out the ballot itself. The ballot itself has no one's name on it. It's untraceable. You have now destroyed any ability to validate that they did it properly. So there's one shot and one shot only. It's not like a recount can fix this. You need to be close enough to see what's going on to make sure it's being done properly. Now, if you believe, and I'm sure most people do, that more of the mail-in ballots favored Biden than favored Trump, then you would have an incentive to accept as many of those mail-in ballots as you could if you were eager to see that Biden wins and you're not ethically handling the election. And so that is why you need someone standing by making sure they're not willy-nilly accepting ballots that are invalid under the law, because they're just trying to count as many for Biden as they can, regardless of whether they follow the law, regardless of whether it's signed by the elector, regardless of whether there's a secrecy ballot, regardless of whether there's markings on a secrecy ballot. If they could get away with it, and if they were so motivated, then they could be counting lots and lots of ballots, especially in counties where you expect not only the mail-in votes to favor Biden, but to favor him heavily. So that's why. It matters that you have meaningful poll watching going on, and if when you have, like they had reported in Philadelphia and in Pittsburgh, but poll watchers being denied meaningful access in various ways. Cameras not even in the same. They'll comment in the media that, well, there were cameras, even if you couldn't stand close enough. But there's complaints that the cameras weren't focused
right.
in a way to allow proper inspection either.
But do you agree with me, though, that the idea that you would get, the United States Supreme Court to set aside 682,000 ballots based on that infirmity is highly unlikely?
Yeah, it's an uphill battle. I mean, your standard of evidence to prove voter fraud sufficient to overturn an election is generally clear and convincing evidence. So you would need, I would believe, you would need some sort of whistleblower type evidence where someone said, yeah, they kept all the poll watchers back, but actually I was close enough to see, and I swear, you know, this is what the person was doing. They were counting votes with no secrecy ballot. They were counting votes with no signature. If you could get enough evidence that not only could they have done that, but they actually did that, they actually improperly counted votes to, you know, sufficiently undermine the confidence in the election, then you could potentially get a court to rule that, you know, to throw out the election results in various ways. There's different kinds of remedies. Also, I mean, an overlooked potential is ultimately it's up to the House to accept the electoral votes from any given state. So if you could persuade the House to vote to refuse to accept the votes from the electoral votes from a particular state based on fraud or based on so many irregularities that they just don't trust the results.
Yeah.
And again, you could, but again, it's an extremely high standard to get Congress to.
Yeah.
Electoral
ballots. One other thing is trying to get a handle on the cured ballots issue. Is there any sense of how many ballots we're talking about that were cured, you know, in terms of another cohort of votes that could be set aside because of the differing standard?
I have not seen any attempt to quantify that. That, again, is something that will be no doubt brought up in the lawsuits challenging that particular issue. But I don't have that access to that total.
He is Greg Tufel. He's the founder of OGC Law, LLC, based in Pittsburgh. Appreciate your perspective on your legal perspective on all things Pennsylvania election related. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560. The Answer.
On today's shutdown day in Illinois, how are you celebrating?
Who's listening?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. It was interesting to see CDC Director Robert Redfield take to the podium yesterday, have a little presser and talk about K-12 education and where the kids should be, even as cases are spiking. This is what he said.
K-12 schools can operate with face-to-face learning, and they can do it safely, and they can do it responsibly. The infections that we've identified in schools when they've been evaluated were not acquired in schools. The truth is, for kids K-12, one of the safest places they can be, from our perspective, is to remain in school.
One of the safest places they can be, from our perspective, is to remain in school, says man of science.
Science and data. I mean, look at the New York City public schools positivity rate. .167. Those numbers are fascinating. And zero cases of student to teacher transmission. And that's 1,500 students, guys. Well, actually 1,000 were for in-person learning. 500 are doing remote learning because they have a choice there in New York City until recently, till they took away again.
And the threshold that they set for shutting down the schools was 3%.
For the city, right. So, not the school district.
So that it's set school district in New York. So that's the threshold. They're well below that threshold, and yet they're shutting down anyway.
Out of an abundance of caution. That's another term I hope I never hear again. Social distancing, abundance of caution, mask up.
So this is what we mean when we say the goalposts are forever moving.
Yeah.
That this is all arbitrary and capricious. This is sort of a prime example of that. And, of course, it's only the kids and, by association, their families, but particularly the kids that suffer accordingly. And so Randy Weingarten, she is the ghastly teachers union boss, American Federation of Teachers. She's also a shortlister for Secretary of Education in the Biden administration.
Oh, God.
She was on with Martha McCallum on Fox yesterday, and Martha pressed her on. And the reason I like how Martha did this and bringing her on was she's not talking to the director of the New York City Public Schools, the chancellor of the schools, and saying, well, why are the schools shut down? She's not talking to the mayor's office and saying, why are the schools shut down? She's talking to the teachers union boss, because that's who's actually in control of the schools. She puts it to Randy Weingart. Hey, why are you shutting down the schools? Because they are. That's who's in charge. The teachers say we won't work, and Randy Weingart backs them, or they come up with, of course, these ridiculous tangential demands to return to work.
Well, like a new Green Deal.
For example. So listen to this exchange, because Martha McCallum got after her pretty good. I was pretty proud of McCallum.
The problem is that schools are not impervious to all that is going on in the outside. And what the mayor saw today, or the last couple of days, is that in Staten Island and other regions in the city, you were seeing a trajectory that was going way up. And so what Mike Mulgrew and the UFT and others are saying to the city, begging the city, wear your mask. Get the infection rate down, because we want schools to be reopened
hearing,
safely.
The schools need to be open is the point. The kids need to be in the schools, because what's been decided by the CDC, it sounds like the union doesn't want the teachers in the classroom and the mayor doesn't want the teachers in the classroom. The parents clearly want the teachers in the classroom, and the CDC wants them in the classroom.
You're actually not listening to me.
What has happened here
is that New York City was the only major school district in the nation to actually reopen schools
safely. But they're closing now, Randy. Why are they closing now, Martha?
They're closing now because what the city said, and frankly, what lots of other places are also seeing, is a huge skyrocketing increase
Randy, because the science says, yes, everyone agrees, we see a spike, we're in a second wave. You and I totally agree on that. What they're telling us, though, is that the wisest scientific move is to have children in school.
So why aren't they? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Because it's happening here. The suburban school districts, you know, that we talk about all the time that have had some remote learning, they're shutting it all down out of an abundance of caution because the cases are increasing. The cases are increasing, you knuckleheads out there, because we used to test 20,000 people a day back in May and March. Yesterday alone, we tested 113,000 people. And you can listen to Pritzker and Dr. Ezekiel about hospitalizations. You know, there's some hospitals on the brink. No, they're not. We called the data manager at Northwestern Memorial. 76% beds in use. Last year at this time, without COVID, it was 82%.
Yeah, well, it's going to vary hospital.
I know, but some of the rural hospitals, yes, they're having some problems. But what hospitals? Well, give us names. Give us...
But pull back and talk about the kids and something Randy Weingarten said. Well, the schools aren't impervious to the outside world. Right. Yeah, I know. And so while this case spike is going on, what's happening in the schools? Is there material evidence that the schools are spiking the way that the larger society is spiking in terms of infection, transmission? I haven't seen any.
No.
That's sort of Redfield's point at CDC. That's sort of why he's saying one of the safest places for children to be. That's sort of consistent with what we know about children as transmitters.
They're not transmitters. That's the thing.
I mean, you know.
But people don't know that. They're not reading.
Not 100%, but obviously there are infections that happen, but it's a fraction of what's happening in larger society. And as somebody wrote, okay, so the schools are closing, so should I drop my kids off at the bars and restaurants that are staying open? I'll just drop my kid off at a bar. How is that? How do you square that? Well, the schools can shut down, but I'm going to let bars and restaurants limp along at 25% capacity. How does that make sense?
It doesn't make sense. That's the thing. And I want to tell you CPS parents who have kids in high school, your kids are not going back to school this year. I don't care if they come out with a vaccine. Lori Lightfoot has a different plan.
Looking at the literature of studies that have been done across the world, and also knowing what the experience is of 40,000 kids that are in other school systems here in Chicago, is that schools, if those mitigation efforts are taken, are actually quite safe.
Yeah, quite safe. I'm sorry, that wasn't the soundbite, but she did say that they're going to hopefully start with K through 8 in mid-February.
Welcome to the party, Triple Threat.
Yeah, she and Dr. Awardi are now like, oh, no, now they're, but at least they're looking at the new science and data, well, and the new studies.
They still have it all wrong. I mean,
they do.
Here's the thing. We mentioned this the other day. When you just focus on cases as a substitute for prevalence, you do two things. You're 180 degrees off the target. You overestimate the incidence of death. And you underestimate the incidence of transmission. Okay. So you give people a 180-degree different perspective than the reality. You engender unnecessary fear at the same time as you promote, to some extent, more recklessness than people would otherwise perhaps engage in if they understood what the risk exposure really was for transmission. You've got it 180 degrees wrong.
But why are they doing it? I watch them sit up there and lie every day. And I think that they're doing it to scare you into locking yourself in your home, to scare you into compliance, well, because they just want to get through Thanksgiving. They're just buying time until we get a vaccine.
You think they're doing it. They're saying explicitly that's what they're doing. And they're not hiding
it. Don't want to look bad, like, oh, I don't want to lock down, but I'm going to scare you into locking yourself down.
No, but on the science and data, and even when you have a socialist like Lori Lightfoot arguing for schools in-person learning. So why isn't it happening? What does it tell you about K through 12 public education, the government school systems, and not just in the urban centers, but including them, of course? What does that tell you about them in America?
They control the government. Unions control government. That is one thing I've learned through all of this and through the strike last year. They're the ones with the power. And they don't want to go back to school. Why would they? Some of them, I know for a fact, Dan, are teaching from Florida. Their second home's in Michigan. I know one administrator who's in Connecticut at their family cottage there, Arizona. They don't want to come back.
What is it?
Why would they?
And what does it tell you about how school systems are organized? What do you think the mission of these K through 12 school districts is versus what do you now understand the mission is?
They don't care about kids.
Greg and LaGrange.
Hi, good morning. Amy, this is not going to stop. You never want to hear shut down again. The basic idea is the debate in this country has been stripped from us. Stripped. Redfield comes out, makes a statement, and it's declarative. And you have a Danish study about masks and their efficacy, and it's completely shut down.
Yep.
We are ruled by tyrants. It's the tyranny of tyrants. That's probably what Dan said. That's probably where I remember it from. But that's what it is. We're being ruled by Faucis. We're being ruled by the president-elect Bidens. He's not president-elect. We're ruled by technocrats and autocrats and big Twitter account executives like Dorsey and Zuckerberg. People still believe that the 2016 election was hacked by the Russians. We are a dumb citizenry.
People are stupid.
Dumb as the day is long.
Lobotomized, yes.
You cannot get it back unless you change generations. It's going to take a long time, folks.
Well, you can't just undo this. I mean, those kids that are 2 and 3 years old walking around with masks, not even looking at their neighbors, you think that's going to change when there's a vaccine? They might live there a whole generation like that. Not in my family, not in my household.
Well, it's one thing. It's interesting because school choice advocates like myself have long argued for the urgency of rethinking K through 12 education for that very reason. Kids are 8, 9, 10 years old once. You don't get to come back to them 30 years from now and say, oh, we figured it out. So maybe there'll be some urgency now that it's a lot more than poor families who are being affected by these school shutdowns. Maybe there'll be some urgency to force a real rethinking of K through 12 education. Maybe the end of K through 12 education as it has been, and a reimagining, to borrow a word from the left, a reimagining of K through 12 education. What about that, since we're in the reimagination business these days?
Well, even schools that are reopened, I have 8 kids in a class, maybe one, yeah. 5, or because people are so scared. It's either they're lazy or they're scared, or maybe a combination of both.
Right. 8 kids in a class watching the teacher on via Zoom from her home in Florida.
It's going on in Glenbrook South, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Steve in Arlington Heights. Steve in Arlington Heights.
Hey, Steve.
Morning.
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 Oh, okay. I didn't know I was in Arlington Heights. I'm in West Madison, Wisconsin.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay.
Anyway,
sorry.
Same thing, kind of. Just a little
call
different.
Our screener considers those sister cities.
Well, that's kind of funny. But anyway, I sent a copy of that video from the CDC to my son's school principal yesterday and got a response that it's easy for the CDC to say that, but the insurance companies aren't covering our school, because of if the Lake County Health Department says you got to shut down, the insurance company won't cover them.
Oh.
Yeah, that's not compelling to me. Thanks for the call, Steve. The lawyers tell us to this. The insurance company said that. Hmm. Private school is still operating.
Yep. Catholic schools in New York still open, by the way.
So how's that? Maybe it's time to shop around or litigate the issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is my hands are tied. You know, this is classic Illinois political culture and political culture about half the nation. I know it looks like I'm in charge, but I'm not in charge. I know I'm supposed to have this authority, but, you know, I sort of exercise it intermittently when it's easy for me to do things that I otherwise want to do. When it's difficult to do things I otherwise don't want to do, then I just say, hey, my hands are tied. You know, the boys upstairs. The lawyers told me, the insurance company said. Boy, that's a compelling excuse, isn't it, to perhaps negatively impact the intellectual development of children, not to mention their social development, the mental health, for years to come. Is that persuasive to you? It's not to me. Frank in Franklin Park.
Hey, you know, your original question is how you're celebrating lockdown day. I'm actually going to work. I'm working this weekend, too, because I need to make as much money as I can in 2019 before my taxes go up. And also, when it comes to these shutdowns, watch very carefully. They're going to make mandates that we cannot reopen until everybody gets vaccinated. Whoever's going to be making money out of this from the vaccinations are going to be dictating what we do. Follow the money, guys.
Well, Pritzker and Lightfoot both keep saying, no, we're not. There's not going to be mandatory vaccinations. Bull jive. You want to get back in school? I mean, to go to a concert next year, Ticketmaster is demanding that you prove that you have a vaccination or that you get tested 2 days before the concert.
Mm-hmm. With respect to K through 12, this over from our friends at wirepoints.org. 99.82% is the recorded case survival for ages 20 to 49.
99 point what?
82%. 99.99% recorded case survivability for kids.
Yeah.
This is just Illinois. Because it's 20 to 49, the survival rate's higher nationally. But still, 99.82, 99.99 for kids.
And there's been 8 kids that have died in Cook County, and 5 of the 8 we got information on, those 5 all had comorbidities.
99.82, 20 to 49 years old, so under 50.
Right. A lot of teachers are
77% of Illinois teachers are younger than 50. 99.82 survival rate and nearly 80%, nearly 4 in 5 Illinois teachers are under the age of 50.
Get back to class, folks.
What does it tell you? Do you understand it now? Can you share it with your friends? The government schools are set up for the benefit and the convenience of the adults. That is the mission. The mission is not to educate kids, so it's very easy for them to walk away from educating kids in service of their interests. They do it all the time in subtle ways. I'm not talking about every teacher. I'm talking about systemically. There's that word again. Systematic. That's how the system is set up. Third-party administrator for salaries and benefits for the adults. It operates on the convenience of the adults, the interests of the adults. That's why your kids aren't your kids. They're their kids, and they'll get around your kids when they're damn good and ready. Making a general statement, not every teacher, and blah, 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 all the usual qualifications. That's what is so fundamental to understanding if you really want to consider changing education, K through 12, or changing your kid out of the K through 12 system he's in now. Tom and McHenry.
Hey, Dan, Amy, how you doing? What I was wondering was, we need some outside the box thinking on some of the 14-day quarantine problem they got. Because out here in McHenry, I talked to our superintendent, and I was sort of pushing him. I mean, he's a great guy. I think they truly want to get back to school. They want to do a hybrid model. But the problem is, what he indicated was, if staff goes down, you know, they want to get back in school, but one teacher goes down, that's 14 days, and a sub goes down, that's another 14 days. So it's like a half health department guidelines, half staffing issues. So I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, I think they should change their, get a test, and if you're negative, you should go back to school and teach or go back to work. This 14-day quarantine thing is, you can be in quarantine the whole time and never leave because everybody's around somebody who has it, especially now. I mean, even our circle, we know people who have it. No one needs hospitalization, but.
So, you know, businesses have the same problem with losing employees for 14 days because of an infection or because of exposure to somebody who's infected.
Same with the hospital.
You work around it. You have other people pick up the slack. I mean, that to me is even a weaker case than arguing against the insurance company telling you what to do or not do because of some local health department. I mean, it's a staffing issue. Right? Well, find the staff.
In North Dakota, if you're a doctor or nurse and you're asymptomatic, you're still working. You're just going to put on another mask.
Mike in Plano.
Hey, guys. I was surprised to see parents outside of Dutrieur High School protesting last weekend. I always viewed Evanston to be a very wealthy, very liberal community and home of many prominent members of the Stay Home, Save Lives crowd. So can we infer that these good Lakeshore liberals who simply want to do their government proud, that they're now starting to revolt against their own policies? Or is this just a fringe group of people who aren't going to make a difference?
Mike, thanks for the call. It's not Evanston. That would be Evanston Township High School. It's Wilmette, Winnetka, Kenilworth.
Yeah, it was a huge turnout.
It was. It was organized, led by Nutrier Neighbors, which is a grassroots, essentially, parents group, family group in Nutrier. I mean, North Shore is beset by Champagne Socialists, which have destroyed those areas as well as the state. But there are obviously rational, sensible, intelligent, thoughtful people up there. That's who was protesting Nutrier's shutdown.
And they had a huge protest yesterday in New York City. Good for them.
Bill in LaSalle County.
Hey, my wife's district in southwest DeKalb County has been open since August. They were basically told by the DeKalb County Public Health Department that they had to shut down. And they tried to fight it with their lawyers, too. And the lawyers said they have legal liability. The school district put in the wave ventilation system to protect and, you know, UV light. Yeah. There's no reason. The kids are devastated. My wife's middle school kids are devastated. They have to go back to e-learning.
Thanks for the call, Bill.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and you can consider yesterday's press conference that was held by Trump's legal team as sort of an opening statement in the court of public opinion. And both Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell, the two main attorneys, gave closing statements as well that were sort of political in nature. Here are their summations, starting with Rudy.
We cannot let this happen to us. We cannot allow these crooks, because that's what they are, to steal an election from the American people. They elected Donald Trump. They didn't elect Joe Biden. Joe Biden is in the lead because of the fraudulent ballots, the illegal ballots that were produced and that were allowed to be used after the election was over. Give us an opportunity to prove it in court, and we will.
Okay, well, you're going to have that opportunity. Nobody's stopping you from going to court. Sidney Powell, after her dissertation on, really focused on foreign interference in the election, effectively arguing that the foreign interests in these election voting machine, the voting machine hardware and software, cooked the tabulation of the votes algorithmically. And so here's what she had to say.
And I want the American public to know right now that we will not be intimidated. American patriots are fed up with the corruption from the local level to the highest level of our government, and we are going to take this country back. We are not going to be intimidated. We are not going to back down. We are going to clean this mess up now. President Trump won by a landslide. We are going to prove it.
Landslide.
And we are going to reclaim the United States of America for the people who vote for freedom.
Well, I appreciate her William Wallace moment there, but that's not going to be enough in a court of law. And she has a long way to go in terms of connecting all the dots that she has mapped out with respect to the allegations of hardware and software manipulation to change the counts. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined again by John Nolte. He's the editor-at-large at Breitbart.com. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Good morning. Your impressions of what Rudy and Sidney Powell in particular were able to present to bring the public up to speed yesterday.
What I saw was a prosecutor or prosecutors basically doing what prosecutors do. They go before the public. They say, this is what we believe happened. This is who we believe is guilty. This is what it means. Now we have to wait for them to put their case together and do the right thing, which is not to present it on cable TV, but to present it in a court of law where they are criminally liable and under oath if they lie. So I am not feeling any pressure whatsoever. And this is something I think the media is doing to people, especially people on Twitter. We want the evidence now, now, now. You know, they're like little kids in the back. Are we there yet? Mm-hmm. There's a deadline here. And Sidney Powell is not a clown. She's a very serious woman. Another person involved in this is Lynn Wood.
Yeah.
Another person who has spent a lifetime building a national reputation. These people are not part of the Trump show. These are grown-ups. And there's a deadline. Sidney Powell is telling us she has the goods, and she's going to present the goods in a court of law instead of on cable news. That's the way it's supposed to be. I can wait 10 days or 2 weeks to see what she has. If she doesn't have what she says, she's done. She's Michael Avenatti.
Yeah,
but
you know,
I can wait 2 weeks to find out.
Yeah, I agree with you. I both about her as well as Lynn Wood. For those of you who don't remember, represented both Richard Jewell against the federal government, as well as, of course,
yep,
Nick Sandman, the Covington Catholic school kid, against something even worse than the federal government, CNN. and so you're right about that. It is both of them, but especially Sidney Powell, are staking their professional reputation. So I'm inclined to give her the benefit of the doubt. But you're in Adam Schiff territory if you don't prove up. And I mean, what she laid out yesterday is, you know, something out of a Jean Le Carré spy novel, really.
Yeah, and my issue, I'm not sitting here saying she's got the goods. I'm not saying she doesn't have the goods. But what I'm really losing my patience with is people screaming for her to do it now.
Yeah, fair.
As though it's somehow appropriate to present her evidence on Tucker Carlson tonight. It's not. She says she has the goods. I'm an adult. I can wait. Let's see what she brings to court, or if she doesn't bring anything to court. What is the harm in waiting another 10 days or 2 weeks before people? I'm not talking about you guys. But
yeah.
If you look at Twitter now, everybody's jumping down her throat. When did our country become so demented that we think we're supposed to make a criminal case on Tucker Carlson tonight? It's ridiculous. She's doing the right thing. But if she doesn't have the goods, she is done. She's a laughingstock, and she deserves to be.
What about Rudy Giuliani? I mean, I don't know if you recently saw the Borat movie where he had a scene in it, and it was absolutely disgusting. And so when he gets up there and talks, and then, you know, his hair dyes running down his face, it's hard to take him seriously.
I'm just concerned with the evidence. I'm not. Okay. The rest of it's just. I don't care. I don't care about his hair dye. No offense against you, but I know this is all over the media. I don't care about his hair dye. I don't care what Borat did to him. I care about the evidence. And let's see what they got. They either got it or they don't. And
but wouldn't they bring this to the court? I'm sorry for interrupting, but wouldn't they, if they had something really solid, wouldn't that solidify their argument if they brought that forward yesterday during that 2-hour press conference?
Why bring it forward in front of the media? I wouldn't bring it forward in front of the media. All they're going to do, you could bring a smoking gun forward. You could, and the media would turn it into a hoax. The media would claim that it was an act of violence. Why do no one presents their evidence in front of the public? You do it in a court of law. You do it under oath.
Well, yeah, but
that's what they need to do.
Right. But John, I mean, a couple of things here. First of all, Rudy did present some evidence at that press conference. And secondly, I think he needs to, you know, the team needs to, because this is being prosecuted in both a court of public opinion and courts of law. And they necessarily need to keep the public up to speed and coming along with them and understanding what they're doing and the arguments they're making, hearing the quality of the arguments. You don't have to present every exhibit that they're calling together, but they need to be in a position where if the courts start ruling in their favor, if they do have the goods, as you said, that the public finds those decisions legitimate. And so I think it was smart to do this briefing at this stage. They're far enough along. They've gathered enough evidence. But when he's presenting affidavits and he's naming names, because, for example, that woman in Detroit, Jessie Jacob, who works for the city of Detroit and provided an affidavit about what she believed to be improper activities and vote counting in Detroit, you know, that's a good example. And Rudy made the point, look, affidavits are evidence. It's not the sum total of evidence. I probably need more physical evidence to support the claim. But I've got affidavits of people who will testify in a court of law to X, Y, and Z. And that's relevant. And that can't easily be dismissed, even if the press corps wants to dismiss it. I think it's important so that we have something even on talk radio and elsewhere to talk about with the public and have it disseminate on social media and elsewhere to say, you know, you can't just wave off people who are Americans who don't have any particular political motivations that are obvious, that are saying there were things that happened that I saw that were wrong.
I can wait until next week for this or the week after. I don't know why they need to present it in front of a brain media that is just going to destroy it. You know, yeah, they presented a little bit, but I'm talking about the overall case. I'm talking about the case that Sidney Powell is talking about.
Yeah, okay.
Why can't we wait 10 days?
Well,
content?
No, I'm not.
I don't see the problem.
I can wait for it, but it is interesting. I mean, yeah, look, short attention spans in this country. This just in. And you say, like, the media is putting a lot of pressure, the D.C. press corps putting a lot of pressure on. That's exactly right. But you have to recognize that pressure does have an effect, and you have to respond to the reality on the ground. That's part of the reality on the ground.
I cannot think of anything. If this is what she says it is, and I don't know if it is or not, if this is what she says it is, this is massive.
Of course.
I mean, this is the biggest political scandal in our country times 10. If this is what she says it is, and I do not want her prosecuting this case, presenting her case
agreed.
On TV.
Agreed.
I don't want her doing that.
Agreed. I
can wait 10 days.
Yeah, I know, but that's not really my point. I can wait, too. My point is to say you still need to communicate with the public about what you think the story is. And you also need to communicate with the public if you want to make a declaration like she made yesterday, calling for the DOJ to initiate a criminal investigation post haste. I mean, those are just the sorts of things that bring the public along with the arguments that are starting to take form.
I think they did. I think yesterday they said this is what we believe. This is who we believe is guilty. And we're going to prove it in the next couple of weeks. I don't know what more they could have done with that. Than that. To me, I mean, again, if they don't come up with it, this is going to be a catastrophe for them. And it's going to be a catastrophe for Trump. It could potentially ruin any chance he has of running again in 2024.
Yeah. So,
and they deserve all of that if they don't come up with it. But this, I don't understand this. You know, are we there yet? Are we there? I just don't get it. I just don't.
Well, okay. But so going back to where the public stands right now, too, because they're germane to this discussion, as you're describing, this what the reaction will be if they don't present the goods, both for the team as well as for Trump. It was you wrote about this. It was interesting. About half the country says it's likely Democrats stole the election. So it seems like the right now, at least, you still have a majority of Republicans and nearly half the country overall saying that, you know, I tend to lend some credibility to the allegations that Trump and his campaign are making.
Yeah, I mean, when you have 47% of the public, 30% of Democrats saying it was likely or very likely that the Democrats stole the election. I mean, this is a good pollster. This isn't some media pollster that's been lying to us for four election cycles. This is a good pollster. And that is huge. That's massive. 47%, 50% say it wasn't likely. Only 41%, it definitely wasn't likely. So I think they probably have done a pretty good job of presenting their case, and that we shouldn't let CNN
right.
and Twitter convince us otherwise, because people are watching this and they don't live in the media bubble like we do. And they're going, you know, this kind of stinks. And I'll tell you something. I've never seen in my life ever. And I've watched election nights now going back to 1984. I've never seen them stop counting. Ever.
Yeah, me neither.
And yeah. That is a problem.
It is a problem.
That is a and then you see Trump winning. And then all of a sudden,
everyone
boom, Chicago, Milwaukee, Detroit, Atlanta, and Philadelphia just shut down. And when they turn back on, what happens? It's just Biden votes.
Yeah, it's so weird.
Now, I don't know if there's anything going on there, but I'm telling you, that stinks. And I think that's another thing people are looking at. And I think that might be where Sidney Powell is going to zero in.
Well, she offered a theory on why the stop happened. And again, if she can prove that up in a court of law, then, boy, we really have something, as you described, 10x anything that's ever happened in this country on the political corruption front. John Nolte, editor-at-large, Breitbart.com. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, guys. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Yeah, thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Jerron Smith was member of President Trump's administration for a time. We spoke with him on this show. He was an advisor on domestic policy. He had also worked as director of urban affairs and revitalization of the administration, specifically. He went on with Joy Reid, I don't know why, basically to be excoriated as a sellout to his race. Jerron Smith is black. Joy Reid
doesn't like that he's a Republican?
Asking him about the Trump election challenges, what he thinks about them, and then what he thinks about what Trump is doing as a black man. How does he reconcile being a black man and watching Trump try to suppress the votes of black Americans? That's essentially her point.
How do you reconcile as a black man in this country and a voter the fact that your party, the Republican Party, continually is focusing on and going after and trying to invalidate the votes of black people in Detroit, in Atlanta, in Milwaukee, and only doing that in places where black people vote?
Well, I would validate that Trump got the biggest vote tally of African-American voters in 60 years. 60 years, we've had the best number of non-white voters since Nixon. And so I think
I'm asking you, hold on a second. Donald Trump, do you know what percentage of the black vote he got? Do you know what percentage? You know what it was?
12%.
Okay, you don't know. Let me ask you again. I'm going to re-ask you the same question. Just as a black person in this country, how do you feel about this campaign going after the cities where black people vote? Don't you think that is racist?
I mean, you're not even allowing me to talk and respond to you. I'm happy to answer your questions, but if you're going to cut me off in the middle of it, we're not going to have a productive conversation.
It's not possible to have a productive conversation with Joy Reid.
Is that okay. In all of these cities, you know, they're not all black cities. They have white voters there, too. So we're looking at everyone's vote and making sure everyone votes. I think that's what the Trump administration is looking at.
Well,
it's not a racial thing. You had
we'll leave
racial
it.
My thoughts on it.
It is, because these cities are where black people live. But it doesn't bother you. I think you've made that very clear. Jerron Smith, thank you very much for being here. Have a wonderful evening.
Oh, my God.
I'm not even, I mean,
wow.
The argument is so absurd, but that's the identitarian argument about everything. Jason Whitlock writing over at Outkick.com. I am repulsed by the people who have worked tirelessly for more than 400 years to convince black people that our skin color is our most prized asset and defining characteristic. This conceit originally led to our physical enslavement. It has now led to our mental enslavement. White liberals have convinced black people to take God out of the equation and replace him with Barack Obama, LeBron James, Colin Kaepernick, Black Lives Matter, and all the other approved symbols of unapologetic blackness. I object to this insanity. Love of my skin color is not America's salvation. Random white people loving me is not the key to my happiness, freedom, or success in this country. The worship of skin color creates a dangerous level of racial division. White liberals, socialists, and communists are using black people to promote racial anarchy. Nobody has been more on the mark over the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 months writing about racial issues and identitarian politics than Jason Whitlock. And I don't think anybody's been more courageous either in taking on the icons that he takes on in media and entertainment. In addition to just, you know, having the temerity to go on Tucker Carlson's show. That's also, of course, a great offense to the black identitarians, the Black Lives Matter crowd, the identitarians across the board, because as he points out, Whitlock does, being driven by white leftists. Mm. For more on all things identity politics related and where this goes in the coming years, we're pleased to be joined again by Joshua Mitchell, professor of political theory at Georgetown, author of the just released American Awakening, Identity Politics and Other Afflictions of Our Time. Josh Mitchell, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, Dan and Amy. How are you? Thanks Good. For having me.
Good. The sense is that because of pickups in the House by Republicans, unexpected pickups, because of ballot initiatives being defeated in places that were race oriented, in places like California to essentially reinstitute racial preferences, those being defeated so roundly, that identitarian politics and their ideologues really took a blow on November 3rd. My sense is that may be true in an electoral sense in the short term, but that they march on and continue their ascent, really, to power in spite of those results on November 3rd.
Yeah, I do worry about that. The clip that you played from Joy Reid is so very telling. The profound pathology we have at this country at this moment is that we're all denied our individuality, denied the dignity of persons, and relegated simply to our group category. So all black men have to think this way. All women have to think this way. All white heterosexual males are guilty of this profound stain. And that's really the game here. We're trying to come up with a simple way, or rather identity politics is trying to come up with a simple way to grade every single human being on the planet. I don't know if you know this thing called intersectionality score.
Yes.
Where you figure out how many guilt points you have and where you are in the great hierarchy of what I called transgression and innocence. And the whole purpose of politics is simply to build a world around the innocent ones and to purge the guilty ones. This is a profound sickness in our country. And as you said, it's an attempt to deal with transgression and innocence without God, and most importantly, without forgiveness.
In Illinois, and this is just one example, there is a rule that's been proposed by the State Board of Education. So that would be implemented in all of the K-12 school systems in Illinois, if adopted, that would mandate what teachers think, believe, teach, disqualify teachers and lessons plans that don't conform to the culturally responsive teaching and leading standards. This is very similar to the ethnic curriculum requirement that was advanced in California before, somewhat surprisingly, being vetoed by Gavin Newsom, but I think, you know, maybe he's got his eye on bigger things and he just didn't want to take up that fight at this point. It's certainly not like he's not an identitarian, but, you know, there's a time for everything. The culturally responsive teaching standards, the ethnic studies requirements, I mean, this is all in advance of exactly what you were describing identitarian politics to be, and it advances regardless of who's in the Oval Office.
Yeah. So at Georgetown, where I teach, and at other universities, we now have survey questions that our students are supposed to fill out. And one of them is the teacher culturally sensitive? And that's really a code word to say, does this person have the right political opinions? The thing that we most sorely need in our education system and everywhere is diversity of opinion. But that's unlikely to happen. Black people who are conservatives don't count as black people. There's just one way you have to go, and this is a kind of totalitarianism that's creeping in, and we have to fight it. As you said, we've made some electoral pushback, some success here with the latest election, but this has penetrated deep into our culture. And my view of this ultimately is that we're trying to solve a religious problem in politics. The religious problem is, how do we find relief from our guilt? And of course, theologically, you do this through your churches, or if you're Protestant, directly through your relationship with Christ. And when you destroy that idea, but you don't get rid of the guilt, then you try to do it in the world. And so what we're trying to do is to separate the pure from the stained. And this is my argument, is that first, right now we see this coming after white heterosexual men. And please don't misunderstand me. This is not a defense of white heterosexual men.
No, they're terrible.
The logic of this is that once you purge, you know, toxic masculinity, then you're going to go after another group. You have to find somebody who will take upon themselves the sins of the world, somebody you can blame. And it's already beginning to happen. It's white women next. And then after that, irony of ironies, it will probably be black heterosexual men. Because black heterosexual men believe in the church, believe in the conventional family. But as you keep pushing this identitarian viewpoint out to the edges, and you get to the defense of transgenderism, anyone who doesn't believe this, anyone who believes that men are men and women are women, are guilty of transphobia. And so the great irony of this is that black America, which wears the crown of thorns, if you want to use that religious language, which is the basis of the move left, and it was rightly the basis of the civil rights movement. I mean, there are great wounds in America. But the argument goes, civil rights goes to women's rights, goes to gay rights, goes to transgender rights. And when you get to that point, what you have to do if you're defending transgender rights is attack the family as being heteronormative, attack the church as being homophobic. And yet, as Martin Luther King said, and every sensible black and white person in America knows, we have to have conventional families, we have to have churches in order for us to live well. So a movement that begins by rightly thinking through the travails that African Americans have been through in America ends by purging those black Americans who believe in the church and the family, which are the two most important institutions to black America. So it's really, really perverse. And I'm waiting for black America to push back on this. My view is that black America has more moral authority at this moment than it had during the civil rights movement. Because black America alone can say to the Democratic Party, no, it is not the case that the travails of black America goes to the women's movement, goes to the gay movement, and goes to the transgender movement. So, and there are black intellectuals who are pushing back against this. I think you know Bob Woodson well.
Yeah, he's
among those who are doing this. So we have a profound disease in our country, and we're not going to return to health until we treat each other as human beings. And by the way, that's what the rule of law does. So I'll be the first to admit that we have all sorts of problems in our country, but all of them can be solved by treating each other under the rubric of the rule of law. We don't have to purge groups. We don't have to say this group is pure, this group is innocent. We don't have to say if you're a black man, you have to believe this, or you're guilty of conspiring with the devil. But that's where the left is today.
So given the election results, How is it that we're losing? It seems that a majority, even in leftist states like California, agree with probably a lot of what you just said. So why does the side that lost on Election Day continue to win in every other cultural venue?
Well, my sense is that this is the last of their wins, and I hope I'm right, is that America really has gotten to the point, most Americans have gotten to the point, where they've had enough of this. They realize they can't just be reduced to their skin color. But these groups that do this are still immensely powerful. They have control of our universities and our education system. They have control of Hollywood. And my sense is they're going to overplay this. They really think that Donald Trump, who was an accident. And my view is that Donald Trump was elected in large part because he did not care about what identitarians were telling him. I mean, what they were telling him is, look at yourself. You're a white man. You should be ashamed of yourself. And Trump said, I don't feel guilty. I'm proud of my country. My country is good. And I'm sick and tired of you telling me what I should and should not think. That's why he really won. And I think Americans, for the most part, know that he's right, whatever you might think of his tweets and all that, but that he's right and that we can't build a world in this way. And the Dems and the left have still think that they have command of this and they're going to overplay it. So I'm standing back and I'm watching and I'm looking for my opportunities. And every time I get told that, you know, white people are guilty or white women are guilty or black heterosexual men are guilty, and that we can solve the world's problems by purging these filthy groups, what I say is, so you know what? You're going to go home tonight, and no matter who you purge, you're going to still feel guilty, because the problem of guilt is a religious problem. It's not one that can be solved by naming this group or that group. And the best example of this, Dan, the place where it all begins is in Garden of Eden. You go back to Genesis and look at that story. It's an astounding story, and it sheds all the light we need on identity politics. Adam and Eve take the bite of the apple. God comes to Eve. What happened? Who did this? The serpent made me do it. I'm not guilty. Comes to Adam. Eve, the woman you gave me made me do this. I'm not guilty. This says something about the human situation, is that there's guilt within us, and we're always desperately looking for some external object to blame it on. Mm-hmm. And that's what identity politics is doing. It's saying if we could just get rid of those people, everything's going to be fine. But the problem of guilt, if you're Christian, is that it's not about those people out there. It's something in our soul. And that's why I say we're in the midst of a kind of religious awakening, an awareness of guilt, which is what's been present in all the great religious awakenings in America, except in those religious awakenings, you turn to God to solve the problem of guilt. Here, what we're doing is we're saying, I feel guilty. There's something wrong. I know I'm going to blame it on another group. You cannot build a society in that way. And we can do this. We have all the resources. We have this rich variety of people in our society. And imagine what we could do if we stopped looking at each other in terms of our identitarian categories and said, let's build a world together. Let's see what we can do to really do something here and make our world fantastic. That's why I characterize the book as really, I characterize America as really good. There are two alternatives before us. Either what I call the identity politics of innocence and transgression. In other words, you're just looking at the color of other people. Or what I call the liberal politics of competence. Let's forget our colors and identities. Let's see what we can build together. What kind of competencies can we help other people develop? Let's build our communities, our neighborhoods, our cities back. Let's do that instead of trying to figure out who's innocent and who's guilty.
That is just an outstanding distillation, and you can get more outstanding distillations from Professor Josh Mitchell in his recently released book, American Awakening, Identity Politics and Other Afflictions of Our Time. He is Josh Mitchell, Professor of Political Theory at Georgetown University. Josh, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Dan. It's great to talk with you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Mike Scott is all over that brick through Ray Lopez's aldermanic office window this morning. I just wonder when Lori Lightfoot is going to surrender to authorities.
Stop it. The person was wearing a light blue hoodie, yes.
Speaking of radicals in Chicago, interesting piece in the American Conservative, theamericanconservative.com, explaining Northwest Chicago's web of radicals. And, you know, there's all of these anti-American leftist groups circulating. And they sort of have various approaches to the same ends, of course, Marxist revolution. One of them is called ANSWER. We really haven't talked about them, but we should. They don't have the profile of Antifa, by the way, which is not going away. If anything, it's just getting started. Expect more violence from Antifa, particularly after one of their own had a narrowly lost to Ted Wheeler to take over the mayoralty in Portland. But just staying a little bit closer to home, let's talk a little bit about radicals on the streets of Chicago and the relationship they have to some of the radicals that we have in public offices. To help us do that, we're pleased to be joined by Michael Volpe, investigative journalist, author of Sandra Grazzini-Ruckey, and The World's Last Custody Trial. I have to check that out. Michael Volpe, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So this group ANSWER that had been holding rallies on a range of topics prior to, you know, the COVID business and the shutdowns, including on, you know, the standby of 2020, which is defunding the police. Give us the backstory on them.
Yeah, they actually started as a response to 9/11, that we can't go to war. And I don't remember where it was, but I think they put about 50 to 100,000 people at a rally against that. And they've sort of expanded. So they've been around for 20 years. They got chapters in a bunch of different places. If you ever hear of a rally at the Thompson Center or the Daily Plaza, it's very likely they either organized it or at least organized some people to be there. So they're very leftist, and their headquarters is right next to the Kimball stop there on the Brown Line, which is why I call it the Northwest Side. And in fact, they and several other groups that are allies are all around there. And so anti-war, obviously, and they are true blue. So when Obama went into Libya, they were against that. But they're basically against every phantom war during the Trump administration. He's supposedly going to war against Iran, North Korea, now China, Syria, you name it. They see the war boogeyman everywhere. Very pro-Cuba, Venezuela, and those types of groups as well. Open borders, pro-socialism, obviously, pro-Palestine. Pretty much like the gamut of leftist things. I couldn't really track any money. I don't think that they really have that much money, but they can put on a rally.
And what is their disposition? You know, compare and contrast them with Antifa, since that's more of a frame of reference to people, where, as we've seen from undercover video that James O'Keefe and Project Veritas has done, as well as from individuals that were formerly associated with Antifa, like Gabrielle Nadalis, have said that, you know, violence is a feature, not a bug, of Antifa. They completely embrace violence as the means to political ends. And how does ANSWER fit into that?
I didn't really see violence. They get pretty aggressive verbally at their rallies. I think they know me by face, but maybe they've burned some stuff. But I don't think you're talking about like fisticuffs or anything like that that Antifa gets into. But the rhetoric is certainly radical. The other thing is, they've been doing this for 20 years, and they're very good at organizing groups of people to take to the streets so they can get attention. I don't think they're nearly as violent as Antifa, but they've also evolved for a lot longer than Antifa's been around.
And so they also fall in or work in conjunction with the public sector unions for those type of rallies, turnouts, political organizing.
Absolutely.
Political organizing as well.
Right. No, I should have mentioned pro-unions. So, yeah, those rallies, and you can find it. They boast that we coordinated with SEIU on this rally. We coordinated with AFSCME on this rally. Absolutely. They're completely allies. But what I didn't find was any funding moving from SEIU, of which SEIU has hundreds of millions. to this group. It seems like they don't really raise a lot of money, but at the same time, if you can put 50,000 people in front of the Daily Plaza or the Thompson Center, you're going to get attention, and you're going to draw attention to your cause, whether you have any money behind it or not.
And their end game? I mean, in addition to stopping war and utopia and all that.
Right. No, their end game is a leftist utopia that looks kind of, they think Cuba and Venezuela is where it's at. So let's reframe ourselves like Cuba and Venezuela. It's certainly anti anything conservative and Trump. But yeah, no, it would be like a socialist state with little to no police that has absolutely no military.
Well, they've been successful in Chicago, so it's time for them to move on and go somewhere else.
Right. You know, I tracked them. They got a thing in Indianapolis, and there's a couple of shootings there that happened earlier this year. Dejon Reed, I think, is the guy's name. They call him Sean Reed and one other guy. And the one interesting thing is that they happened hours apart, but there doesn't seem to be any connection except for maybe just a general cycle of violence. But they caught on to it as if the police had done something horribly wrong. I can't remember the first guy's name, but he was involved in a robbery. The police answered the call. He got into a shooting match with them, and they killed him. And so apparently Answer thinks that the police did something wrong there. Reed had an outstanding warrant. The cops, caught him for speeding or whatever it is. They get into a chase. He puts it on Facebook Live. He escapes from them a couple of times. He eventually is chased on foot, and he appears to have had a gun. And so he was eventually shot. Now, he was tased first and then shot. And I guess there was a question whether or not he had a gun and whether or not he should have been shot. But, I'm not a police apologist, but there seems to be almost nothing to criticize in either of those incidents. And yet they choose those two as the flashpoint for a reason to so let's start the funding process here in Indianapolis and get rid of the police there. Even though it looks like if you're going to pick two incidents, those are not the two to pick.
And so this is another organization, leftist organization, that's going to continue on with the organizing and the public displays in opposition to policing in support of defunding policing, which we also expect to continue mm-hmm. with Black Lives Matter and other organizations in the coming years.
Right. And look, I watched a couple of their activists on a webinar. So, they put everything online. By the way, these guys are anti-capitalism, but they certainly figured out how to use the technology of capitalists. Yeah. But now they're moving that sort of organizing online, and they're pushing forward. They got a big campaign in Indianapolis to defund that local police department. They got campaigns locally all over the place doing that kind of thing. One group that's allied with them has a study abroad in Cuba. She can learn what Cuba's really like, as opposed to the sure. corporate media here in the U.S. telling you what it's like. A full range of the leftists.
Well, it sounds like a full-time job. I mean, mm-hmm. have you been able to prove that they haven't been getting paid, or they are getting paid? Because that's a lot of work.
It's hard to prove a negative. What I can tell you is I looked, and the only thing I could find was something from Daily Caller 4 years ago where they received maybe $8,000. So, if they're really good at hiding it, I'm not going to say they don't have any money. I could just, I went through SEIU's grants, and there's nothing to them, and there's nothing from anywhere else. And I can't, and they don't list their own 990s, which is interesting because I don't know exactly how they're structured, but if you're structured, I think it's called a foundation, you're supposed to list your tax returns, which they do not.
Yeah.
And I think they call themselves a nonprofit.
Yeah. Imagine a bunch of leftist kooks having their IRS paperwork all tidied up. I'm shocked. Yeah, right. Shocking.
Right. Right. I would just warn them if they can get to Al Capone, they'll get to you. So
yes, right.
If you're doing anything, any malfeasance, right. get it straightened out.
But yeah.
Yeah, look, I'm not saying they don't have funds. I looked and I couldn't find it. I don't want to say, if I can't find it, it's not there. But I think I would have found something more than one line item from 4 years ago for 10 grand.
There's sort of all these disparate groups, but it seems like with the left and these Marxist revolutionaries, they may have their own bag going, different groups in same cities, different groups in different cities. but they all come together for the same thing, to promote the defunding of police. If there's a police involved shooting, as you say, they run to where there is action. That seems to be what we've seen over the last couple of years. And this is another group, but it's had a particularly large footprint in Chicago.
Right. Well, look, I one of the reasons I did this article is I watched them like 3 or 4 days after Trump got inaugurated in 2016, with their one chief organizer saying this is the resistance, with signs saying he's anti-Muslim, he's a racist, he's a homophobe, he's a misogynist. All of the most toughest criticisms of Trump were there at this rally that they organized, including the term resistance. 4 days after he was elected, he wasn't even technically president yet, and yet all of the things that they've said about Trump were said by this group 4 days after he was elected. So they may not have money, but they seem to influence the debate somehow, or it's a total coincidence, and I don't believe in coincidences. I don't, you know, they were using the same terminology that's been used for 4 years, and it wasn't started there, but it was certainly there. Can't possibly say that Trump was anything before he was even president. So if you're saying he's got anti-Muslim policies, anti-black policies before he's even president, it's like somebody's giving you talking points.
Yeah, they were still working out the Manchurian candidate accusation then. Michael Volpe, investigative journalist, author of Sandra Gerzini Rucki and The World's Last Custody Trial. Michael, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, this COVID casualty is a real kick in the pants.
Was it covalicious? That's a new term now.
Parkside Pub in Huntley has decided to postpone its annual Turkey Testicle Festival.
Oh.
Yeah.
I've been there. I covered that once, the Turkey Testicle Festival.
Covered it. Yeah, right.
It's a big
covered
deal.
Yeah.
No, when I worked at Channel 5, I thought they were joking, like, no, here's a solo cup full of turkey balls. I'm like, well, that sounds great. What could go wrong here?
And you went back for seconds.
Well, it's good. It grows on you. It's better than venison.
And in you.
Yes.
Yeah. So after
venison. 30,
after 38 years.
But Venice is wonderful this time of year.
I know. Name assassinator, English language assassinator. After 38 years of hosting the festival, Parkside Pub said, can't do it this year. Not gonna do it. But, we'll try to resume next year if the governor.
If there's a vaccine and people take it.
If the governor can find his testicles and reopen Illinois.
You know what? Okay.
He literally cannot find them, I only meant that metaphorically.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Open mic! Open mic Friday! Call in now! Open mic Friday!
Dan and Amy taking your calls, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Comments, concerns, critiques, compliments, crackpot conspiracy theories, we'll take them all.
Yeah, how are you spending your Tier 3 mitigation day one? Anybody going to any group exercise classes that can tell me about? Anybody defying the orders? I mean, really. And then just like clockwork, just like that, history repeats itself. Pritzker yesterday saying just this one Thanksgiving, everybody stay home except for his wife and daughter who already fled, just like they did last time.
Just for this year, please stay home.
If you've not canceled your Thanksgiving travel plans, now is a good time to be having that really difficult conversation with friends and family.
Anybody having that difficult conversation with friends and family?
In Oregon, this is a new one.
Yeah.
How
could it get worse?
The competition from all the lockdown and bust governors, Kate Brown, she's one of them. The lockdown there, a 2-week freeze, it's being,
it's not a pause, it's a freeze. I love these terminologies.
2-week freeze, it's being, described as, it was decreed on November 13th. Limiting social get-togethers indoors and outdoors to no more than 6 people total. And also, this is the kicker, from no more than 2 households. Okay. And will people be coming by and knocking and checking? Probably not. Andrew Cuomo was asked about that the other day.
Yeah, he tried to get the sheriff's office.
And he said, you know, it's hard to stop. It's hard to restrict. It's very hard to regulate. It's very hard to police. But if you see it, stop it. So there won't be proactive policing on it, but they certainly want the police to do these lockdown and bust governors and mayors. They certainly want the police to harass people if they see something that violates these unprecedented restrictions in people's private lives, in people's private lives in their private spaces. Interesting stuff.
And the CDC, for the first time, is asking people to not travel for Thanksgiving. But if you do, make sure as soon as you arrive at your destination, you wash yourself, you wash your clothes. Yeah, take a shower, wash your clothes, put your luggage away from everybody else in a secure spot where
I'll tell you what,
there's some germs.
I'll tell you what, you know, the CDC can send somebody over to wash me. I'm not washing myself. You want me wash? You come over. You send one of your goons over to wash me.
And then, of course, if you're eating food, just have one person serving up and sit, you know, in separate tables, 6 feet apart from each other, and wear masks and have some ventilation going on. Their windows open with a cross breeze, or keep your fan on in your house.
Oh, exactly. Windows open in snow country on Thanksgiving Day. It's so refreshing. Rich in Indian Head Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yes, good morning, Nan and Amy. I want to thank you guys for your voice every day, and I look forward to listening to you every morning.
Thank you.
I got two quick things. First thing is this for the Democrats and the never-Trumpers. Do they actually think that this stumblebum Biden and his drunken vice president is going to make this country better than what President Trump has in the last 4 years? And the second thing is what is the purpose of an all-black officiating crew on Monday Night Football? What does this accomplish?
I don't know.
I don't know. He doesn't watch football anymore.
I don't know. Did they take notice of that? Is that like something historic?
I mean, is this this showing us the diversity in pro football? Or is this an oxymoron like jumbo shrimp?
I don't know. Thanks for the call, Rich. I don't know.
Addressing
what?
What's the point? What's he saying?
What he just said.
Okay.
Oh,
wash your hands, Dave.
Ed in Oak Brook.
Yeah, you know what? I got a few things I want to just say, and then I have a few questions for you guys. I actually like the news conference of Juliana. I think the media, the reference to Cousin Vinny was, it was funny. But you know what? That's what the liberals are concentrating on this morning. So I'll bring attention to the news conference. I think there's a ton of irregularities that we all brought up. And then the Democrats have a very bad reputation. We all admit to that. So here's my questions, Dan and Amy. Does anyone think the Democrats would not try and steal this election? And then here's the other question. Do you think the guys on the Supreme Court, who the Democrats lied about, I'm talking about Kavanaugh and also Thomas, don't remember or forget how the Democrats lied about them? So if you guys could answer that, I'd appreciate it. And I'm going to hang up. Have a nice show. Thank you.
Thanks, Ed. Well, in terms of Kavanaugh and Thomas and their memories, I mean, yes, I'm sure they have very good memories. They're smart guys, so I'm sure they remember. Thomas has spoken about it before. Kavanaugh, not so much, but someday he will. But that doesn't mean it influences their decision making on the merits on cases that come before them. I wouldn't suggest that. With respect to the Democrats and who does or does not believe they would try to steal an election, yeah, I know this has never happened before, even though it's part of, you know, the annals of Chicago history, right? Mayor Richard J. Daley and delivering the 1960 election for John F. Kennedy. But okay, it doesn't happen. Sure. Interestingly, we talked to John Nolte from Breitbart at the top of the 7 o'clock hour this morning, and we talked about Rasmussen polling on the topic. 47% of the country, 47% in this Rasmussen poll, Democrats probably stole the election. 52% say they probably didn't. So basically 50-50 on the issue in the country. It's a 50-50 country right now on so many things, especially things related to President Trump. But obviously there's a lot of people who live in big cities. Even Democrats will admit the history of the administration of elections in places like Cook County and Milwaukee County and in Philadelphia and in Detroit. I mean, this is not news. This is not stunning that there would be voter fraud accusations in some of these jurisdictions, but I know the D.C. press corps wants to pretend we're starting history anew on November 4th. Bill in Cape Coral, Florida.
Yes. I was wondering, what about Pacific Gardens? Are they going to be able to feed the homeless and all those people that rely on Thanksgiving dinner in the city there? And the other question, the other little point is, the guy in the runoff in Georgia that's running for Senate, and he preaches in his sermons and stuff at church.
Right.
The thing that's scarier than what he says is with the roar of applause that he gets from his parishioners.
Yeah.
That's scarier than him. That means there's more people that think like him.
Well, yeah, thanks for the call. But, I mean, you know, different churches are going to have different perspectives. I mean, Jeremiah Wright got roars of applause, too, including from the Obamas. The scary thing is that as Georgia voters come, statewide, get to know who Raphael Warnock actually is in terms of what he believes based on what he has said, mainly during preaching time from the pulpit, that could be a 50-50 race. That's a scarier thing in a state like Georgia. Terry in Rogers Park.
Yeah, I'd like to say that I detest the phrase size matters that some not so nice women have promoted to degrade men. If they didn't have such big stretched out vaginas, they wouldn't need to be saying size matters.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Mamie. I'm sorry. I had to say it.
Okay. Well,
it's true.
That reminds me of one of my favorite Curb Your Enthusiasm episodes.
Yeah.
Small pee-pee or big vajayjay? Terry from Rogers Park.
Well, good
morning.
Yes, hello.
Didn't think I would hear that phrase this morning. But you never know what's going to happen on Open Mic Friday.
No, you never know. Freedom of speech, right?
Yeah. And I'm sure there's a lot of men out there right now saying, thank you, Terry from Rogers Park, for saying that size does not matter. And as we learned yesterday, they're probably bankers and the financial sector are lawyers.
Yeah, and I got a text message saying, wasn't Dan a lawyer? Mm-hmm. Rather than an artiste, do you put yourself a few inches ahead of the other profession?
Every inch matters. No, I've never practiced law. I'm in the arts column.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Just so you know.
All right.
Great point, though. Thank you for asking. Corey in Lake Mills, Wisconsin.
Hey, good morning, guys, and thank you for listening to me. I got three quick items. First one is labels. You know, if we got rid of all the labels that we have, we might be better off, you know. I'd rather be just plain old human as opposed to a white, grumpy old male.
All right.
Second
human
item.
Yeah.
Thank you. Second item, going to a big spreader event outside of Milwaukee tomorrow morning, and everybody in Chicago should be going. Sheriff Clark.
What's
it? A big rally outside of Milwaukee.
A Stop the Steal rally, or what's the rally?
Yeah, it's a Stop the Steal and show support for our president and our country. 11 o'clock on the west side of Milwaukee.
Okay, all right. Thanks.
And the third item. Weird.
He's not
Will
down.
Publishers Clearinghouse allow us all to get our votes in late to win? I'm thinking about maybe December 9 or 10 to contact them.
Right. Thanks for the call, Corey. Appreciate it. Oh, by the way, a programming note. I don't want to forget this. Our friend Charles Love, he's got a new show starting this Sunday on these airwaves, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. You know, he was with Black
Johnny
and Wright
Anthony.
With Johnny Anthony before he moved over to New York. And he's starting a new show this Sunday on our airs, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. So check out Charles Love. He's a good guy, thoughtful guy. Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Good morning, Amy and Dan. Let me offer a history lesson for your listeners under the age of 60. I wish to recall this anniversary coming up Sunday, November 22nd, 63. It was 57 years ago, and it seems just like yesterday for me. I just remember that weekend. It's indelibly in my brain. I was changing classes in high school on that Friday, and I heard Kennedy was shot. As I was leaving the school that day, I learned he was dead. My first thought was actually Johnson was president. And 1 year later, Johnson was elected in a landslide as, quote, the peace candidate against conservative Barry Goldwater.
Yeah, right.
However, Goldwater did establish the beginnings of conservatism, the realignment of voting patterns, and he gave us Ronald Reagan.
A time for choosing, four, yes, right?
Yeah.
Yep,
4 years later, 4 years later, Johnson was in so much trouble with his, quote, peace. He chose not to run in March 31st, 68. And finally, let me conclude for the people out there. What happened to the party of JFK? He was a moderate. He would never be a part of the Democratic Party today.
Thanks for the call, Bob, and the history lesson and the reminder about the anniversary of the Kennedy assassination.
All also known as Sean from Elmwood Park's birthday.
Oh, that's right. You know what else
he said, Toots, you'll never forget it now that I told you that. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a pretty good impersonation. You know what else the same date as the Kennedy assassination?
What?
The death of C.S. Lewis. Oh. Yeah, on that day.
The same day? Wow.
Got overshadowed for obvious reasons.
Well, it's just like Farrah Fawcett dying the same day Michael Jackson did.
It's just like that.
Kind of, but a little different.
It's exactly like that. It's perfect. Perfect comparison.
Well, Charlie's Angel is dead and nobody cared. It was all about Michael Jackson.
I cared. Ralph and Rantoul.
Good morning. So my first job out of college, I had a boss that would eat anything on his world travels. Mm-hmm. This is your turkey testicles thing that came to mind.
Yeah.
So he was telling me about it. He was in Bangkok, and he was eating gnat balls.
Gnat balls?
How big are they?
Gnat like balls? You can't even see
like
them
eating. From like a cotton candy thing. So I was telling our friends this. For dinner, you know, he said, you know, he was having this little scoop of gnat balls. He said they were really sweet and sticky. And my friend just sat speechless and said, how do they get the testicles off the gnats? I said, no, Scott, not gnat testicles, balls of gnats held together with like syrupy, gooey stuff.
Oh,
that would be difficult. Oh, yeah,
that's a delicacy. So, yeah, no, that's oh, sure.
Apparently.
Yeah, that is how I like my balls of gnats, too, is sweet and sticky.
The entire gnat. If you're going to eat a gnat, you got to eat the whole thing.
Thanks for the call, Ralph. It's funny, too. Sweet and Sticky was the name of my high school band.
All right.
It was a Poison cover band.
It's a line of yoga pants, too, I believe.
Boy, okay. Now who's Terry from Rogers Park?
I'm so sorry.
Robert in Lakeview.
Oh.
Hey, good morning. As with each day that goes on in this election for Trump seems more and more unlikely, at least to me. I know you guys are reporting on it every day.
Yeah.
And I appreciate it. I kind of doing an autopsy here and just keep coming back to this is really a golden opportunity for the Republicans. With all of the stats that have come out and growing the electorate, the pickups in the House, keeping the Senate, I feel like the Democrats just want to keep pushing COVID because they don't want to address the real issues that Trump was getting at. And I just really hope that, say, Trump is out, they keep pushing the battle with China and they keep pushing illegal immigration and limiting immigration because those are the issues. Those are the real issues in this country, not COVID. COVID's going to pass. Going to work itself out. I just hope that these Republicans and the establishment doesn't cower when he's gone or when he's out.
Good observations, Robert. I agree with you. The only thing I would say, a caution, you know, control of the Senate. Still in doubt. Do not take those Senate races in Georgia for granted.
No.
We've been talking about that all week. Kim Strassel actually had a good piece in the Journal yesterday making the same point because she listens to me. Jim in Evergreen Park.
Yeah, hey, Dan, how you doing?
Good.
Good. Hey, just a quick question. If you get caught stealing, whether it's $1,000 or $10,000, you get convicted of stealing, correct?
Yes. Well, you don't even get arrested here, much less prosecuted in Cook County, but theoretically, yes, that's right. It's stealing. Stealing is stealing.
So if they can prove voter fraud, does it really matter that they can't produce the numbers needed to overturn the election results when they can prove that there was voter fraud by the DNC?
Well, thanks for the call, Jim. Look, you know, what they can prove, taking up these cases is more compelling if the outcome is in doubt. But if there are instances where there is enough proof to charge people with voter fraud, of course people should be charged regardless of the impact on the outcome of the election. Mike in Franklin, Tennessee.
I've called before, but now more than ever. You know, my dad was in World War II, and all in our house, we always had the book Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Mm-hmm. If you pick it up now, it's a new edition. What Hitler did to Germany is what the Democrats are doing to America. All newspapers were told what to publish, how to write the news and editorials. History was cleaned up. It's scary. When I pick up the book, you know, my wife says, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm looking at history." It is so scary. Read the chapter, Life in the Third Reich, Control of the Press, Radio, and Films. And that's America today.
Well, it's
what
not.
Do you think?
Thanks for the call, Mike. It's not America today. And there are elements in American society that are authoritarian, totalitarian. These Marxists that want to overthrow the government and the market system and institute you know, some Jacobin utopia. No question there are elements there, but that's not where the majority of the country is. I think there are all kinds of reasons to be concerned, but I also don't want to overstate the case. And you saw the results on November 3rd were decidedly mixed, and that identitarians and some of those Jacobin thugs were beaten back around the country, weren't they? It just varies significantly from state to state is what I find.
All right. Thank you so much for making us part of your morning. Do you want to squeeze in one more call? Yeah. Where's Chuck from Delavan?
Yeah, that's what I was kind of waiting Chuck? For him for the close. I feel empty without him.
I know.
Maybe. All right. Mike in Union. You're there on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Hey, you know, I don't have any confidence that that Trump's going to get reelected due to the swamp. It's a little parting gift. I would say that Trump would have to demand the Durham report through Barr and throw the hammer down. It's a little parting gift and say thanks, everybody. Have a good day. But thanks for what you guys do. And I don't know how you do it. I had to take a few days off from all this crap, but
I know.
We're back.
Thanks for the call.
It's hard. A lot of people had to take a few days off.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.